one of the things I don't have is fear of authority. You know, I don't put anybody on a pedestal, actually. I'm not that they don't deserve to be, and some of them are close to it, but actually, generally speaking, not a good idea, that I don't speak to anybody. So I wasn't afraid to go and talk to ministers about what I thought. And what surprised me more than anything was that in general, they usually agreed with me. In public, they didn't.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast. Today we're saying hello to Roma Hooper. Roma describes herself as a social entrepreneur and experienced chair who's committed to social change and supporting the charitable sector. She's chairperson at Clinks and the Prison Radio Association. Roma, you've done very many things. You're also involved mainly as chair in a vast range of organisations, which I won't read out as we won't have time for a conversation. But just to say welcome to you today, and we're looking very much forward to our conversation.
Thank you, David, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's so good to have you on, Roma. And just looking at your CV, you've got such an impressive range of activities that you've been involved in throughout your career. I wondered if you could tell us something about how you came to be interested in criminal justice, and to some degree I think it'd be fair to describe you as a criminal justice influencer, actually, in terms of the range of activities you've done. How did you end up with a career path like this?
It was purely by accident. I used to work for a children's charity called Contact to Family, which is called Contact now. It's working with disabled kids. And I used to be their sort of main fundraiser there for quite a long time. And then I had my children and decided that I needed to have a break away from that. So I stopped and decided to do a degree in my early 40s. We had moved house to Twickenham, and my next door neighbour, who is Mark Robinson, came over to me one day. She said, "Roma, I need your help. There's been this horrendous article in the local paper about Feltham young offenders. There have been 5 suicides by young children during the course of 12 months. And this was about 1992, so, you know, 30 years ago. And it was just a closed shop. And the plea was from the governor saying, can you please help? We need help, basically. And Mark's idea was that what they needed was a radio station. There was no television then. Very few people could read and write. The same old things, actually, that prisoners face today. And he said, would you help me raise the money? Having just decided that I never wanted to fundraise again, I said to him, all right, I'll come with you and we'll talk to one of the governors. And we went to Feltham. He introduced me to a governor called Steve Guy Gibbons. And I was used to working in a very difficult environment. Oddly enough, disability in children was really difficult when I was working on it. There was very little being done to support families. So when I went, I just thought, I can't not do this. I thought what I was doing was hard. This is really hard. These young people are getting nothing. And they're children, a lot of them. And I mean, they were just only a bit older than my own kids. So basically, I agreed to support Mark as a volunteer to set up what turned out to be the first prison radio station in the world. But not being one to sort of step back, once I got to know Feltham, quite quickly I got invited to go on to the little mini board of a charity called Feltham, Friends of Feltham, which had been set up by somebody a couple of years before. So that was 1992, and then we didn't launch the radio station until 94. But that's when I began to get seriously interested in criminal justice. And quite frankly, I was completely hooked.
Given how fearful of technology the prison service is, I wondered how you managed to overcome all the challenges that you must have encountered to get a radio station starting. I think to do something quite. I was reflecting with a friend this morning that new things in prison. Prisons are slow to take up change and often hide behind security. But then once something's happened and it works well, then they all want it. And I suppose I'm really curious about how you managed to sell them the idea that they wanted a prison radio in the first place.
I think the governor, a guy called Joe Whitty, who sadly subsequently died, he was very much in favour of this idea of prison radio because there was so little communication available to the young people in their cells. And they were being locked up 23 hours a day, not so different than they are now, which is a real tragedy. So he was very enthusiastic. He also got on board a couple of officers, a guy called Bob Clements, who came on board, who said he will help you. And honestly, it was like big borrowing and stealing. They weren't going to pay for anything. But what they were going to do was give us the space to put it in. And so that was sort of the beginning. And I don't think that anybody in the prison really knew what was going on. We just sort of cracked on with it. And we got to know people within the radio sort of industry. And the only way that we could actually communicate with the young people was through this conductive loop system. So honestly, you wouldn't believe we had to put wires across all the ceilings going into their cells. And we built a relationship with Sony, who gave us these little mini transistor radios. So that one, that we could give them away for nothing. Two, we got them so cheap that they could sell them for a fiver through their canteen. And it meant that we could actually then proceed to communicate with them. But we could only do it during the course of the day. We couldn't run it all night. But it was the beginning of using a system. It was called 999 FM, which is really suitable, actually, I thought. 99 AM, I apologise. But it was the conductive loop system. It changed dramatically over the years. But that's how it started. And it was very much music orientated. It was quite sort of relaxed. But one of the things which became very evident as we began to grow and when we were getting a lot of interest from other prisons about what we were doing was that our mental health department at Feltham realised that using radio was really, really helpful to the young people who were hearing noises in their head. So we developed a really good relationship with the team. And whenever they got somebody in who was clearly extremely distressed, we were able to give out radios to them. So there was no question of them having to buy one or anything else. We could just give them. But it did generate. Once we launched in 1994 with the support of Classic FM, who did it with us, it just began to sort of creep out. So about 95, 96, we were getting other prisons interested. But of course, we were all still stuck with the technology that we were faced with in terms of conductive loop systems. But what was increasingly obvious that was the technology was beginning to change. And I began to see the satellite was going to be something which could be a real game changer. But in the meantime, we had to be very careful running prison radio because it was developing. We were doing a lot less music stuff and doing a lot more educational, a lot more support. And we were able, I suppose it was about the late 90s, to employ somebody who had been a volunteer on one of the reading programs to come in and be our tutor. All the time, all I was doing was raising money and persuading people to give us money for the equipment because we had a studio. The equipment was huge. And in the summer, it would be 100 degrees in there. It was so hot. And we were beg, borrowing and stealing CDs, anything that we could use for nothing. It was extraordinary. People were very generous because it was so unusual. It did sort of capture people's imagination. So the 90s was really the growth and the birth of prison radio, seeing how it spread out, getting other prisons interested and beginning to knock on the door of government to say, you know, we've got something here that you might really, really welcome. So going back to your first question, Naomi, it was just by pure chance that I got involved with prisons. And in the meantime, with my degree, I went on and did a master's in criminology at the London School of Economics, because by that time, I was passionate about it. I wanted to write more about what was going on in prison. So I did both my dissertations on what was going on in prison. And, you know, I finished my degree doing that. So it became, and is still now, a lifelong passion. And I think more than anything, what inspired me more than anything were the young people I met. I met some amazing, and still do meet, some amazing young people, full of potential, who never get a chance. And quite honestly, we write them off, and we shouldn't write them off. We absolutely shouldn't write them off. And Lord David Ramsbottom was always very clear about that. You know, we mustn't underestimate the huge contribution that young people who've been in prison can make if we only do them proud and do what we should be doing to support them. So yes, that's how it all started, by chance.
that's so powerful, isn't it? I mean, that's a theme that's come up regularly in our podcasts, actually, is guests talking about the power of somebody believing in you and what a difference that can make to your life chances. And even the podcast we're publishing tomorrow with Michael Hallett and Byron Johnson, they're talking about how faith in prisons has often been the first time that people have experienced unconditional positive regard. So it crops up regularly, that sense of how important it is to have belief.
There was I mustn't forget to say one very interesting comment. I was in the radio station one day before I worked there, and I was chatting away to some of the lads in there, and we were talking about being, you know, what we did, and what, and he asked me what I did, and I just, well, I come in and help you. He said, and are you paid? And I said, no, I'm not paid. I'm a volunteer. He said, do you mean you come in here to help us for nothing? And I suddenly realised they saw the real value in being a volunteer. And it's one of the things which I've held on to so tightly, because so often volunteers are branded as do-gooders, and it's shocking. We wouldn't be where we are now if there weren't people out there who do things for nothing. And it was the fact that the look of surprise on his face, that actually anyone was prepared to do it for nothing because they believed in them.
Yeah, very powerful, isn't it? I wondered whether being a volunteer makes it easier or more difficult to push for change in a prison environment. I mean, as a civilian staff member working for the NHS, you often get messages about how you're not quite part of things and get treated with suspicion. I'm just wondering what that was like for volunteers.
I think we were definitely treated with suspicion. And I think people were quite confused about the word voluntary and voluntary sector. People assumed that because you're working in the voluntary sector that you were doing it for nothing anyway. But you're quite right. It was a problem, which was one of the reasons why when I finished my degree and I'd already been invited to sit on the senior management team as a volunteer, people were so surprised. But actually in the end, I thought, well, I'm doing all this work, I ought to really try and see if I can be paid. So I became the first voluntary sector coordinator in the prison, and was paid partly by the prison service and partly by the Paul Hamley Foundation. Did it give me more credibility and more scope? Probably not. I had a job to do. So in that sense, one of my jobs was to bring together all the voluntary sector, make sure they're all properly trained. If they were key trained, they knew what it meant. Make sure also that I worked with a lot of officers to talk to them about the value of the voluntary sector. And I got the voluntary sector to work much more closely together. The other thing I did, which I thought was really important, was that I said, because people were very keen to work in Feltham. I mean, it didn't have a great reputation. People were very keen. I said, look, that's fine. You can come and work here, provide funding, et cetera, but you're not coming in unless you can provide something on the outside. I cannot have these lads being let down again by being given really good support in prison. They go out to absolutely nothing. But there was a switch, and you might remember in the early 2000s when prisons began to realise that they needed to have a bit more control over the voluntary sector. So the only way they could do that was to fund them. That, I think, was the challenge, because there's something about being independent financially that gave us scope. I remember one of the governors coming up to me one day, it must be about late 90s, because it was when I was doing my degree, and he said, Roma, who are all these people wandering around my prison? I want you to go and find out. And he asked me to work with another governor. I want you to go and find out who they all are. I don't know who they are. So we created this great book with all the voluntary sector agencies down there and all the people who were involved. And there were about, I don't know, 200 volunteers going in. And he had absolutely no idea. I mean, no criticism to him, because there was no method to gather that kind of information. But we had amazing things going on in there. Fantastic art programs, drama programs. I mean, the housing, you know, health, all sorts of things, jobs. But he didn't know who they were, which was a shame. I think he certainly valued it when he realised how lucky he was.
You mentioned earlier in a bit of a throwaway comment about the prison service not wanting to pay for anything. And I suppose part of the problem for the prison service is so badly resourced compared to other sections of society, and that kind of like reluctance to invest more. Do you think the public appreciates what the cost of the cost, I don't mean financial cost, but what the cost is in terms of not resourcing prisons is to society?
I've had some really interesting conversations with people about that. And in general, the public have no idea how prisons are run. They have no idea what it's costing them. They've got no idea about the voluntary sector agencies that are working in prisons. They all think, and I find this astonishing, they all think they come out with a job. Everyone thinks they come out with somewhere to live. And when you tell people, which isn't difficult because they do listen, if you tell people actually the reality, they're horrified, because no one talks about the damage that occurs if you don't support people in prison, and that they're paying out of their taxes good money going after bad, because quite frankly, most of it just drains away. So one of the things that I have spent the last few years doing with a friend and colleague is looking at how we can reframe the criminal justice debate, because I honestly don't think it's the public's fault that they don't know. Because I think they feel that prison is going to rehabilitate and send people out to be better. And of course, with a very high level of reoffending, which has been the same pretty well all the time I've ever worked in prisons, clearly is not working. Whatever's going on in prisons is not working. Ever since Michael Howard said prison works, we have to fight against that and say, look, you know, prison works, but community works too. You know, and it's better and cheaper to provide services for people before they come into prison. Work with them sooner. So I don't think the public don't mean to care. They just don't care because they don't have the information. My sense is that when you get a chance to talk to people in a way that reaches out to them, in a narrative that reaches out to them, they are surprisingly open. I mean, some of the work I did with my campaign was with victims. And most of the time, people just don't want it to happen to somebody else. Actually, for a lot of them, they're angry with the police, not angry with the offender or the person who committed the crime. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of misnomers going on. And I think it doesn't matter which government, but there's a real drive to push this punitive attitude towards many people who are in prisons, who are very unstable, very traumatized, very complex needs, and none of which is really explained. But if you explain to somebody on the street, they do get it. They do get it. We just give them more chance. But I could go on about that forever.
No, I think that's our experience too. I just wanted to come back briefly to, you spoke about how valuable the radio was as a resource for young people who were hearing voices, but I wondered what other impact there was for the young people that got to listen to the prison radio.
One of the areas where we found ourselves doing quite a lot of work with was that once the station was properly up and running and we had a manager and, you know, the prison were behind us, we were very often working with young people who were about to start life sentences because they were traumatised. And there was something about being in the radio station that presented a sort of cocoon. And because it was basically the whole thing, the whole place was characterised with respect and kindness and thoughtfulness. And we never had any problems with the young people we worked with. But I realised as I was sort of early 2000s, when we were getting more cases coming in who were serving life sentences, how much that helped people. I mean, there was somebody who had attention deficit disorder. He was in such a state, and he would come in and the officers would say he calms down when he comes in. So it became a place of sanctuary for many people. And the other thing it did was, because the kids were so keen to read the news out at 1 o'clock, if they couldn't read, that was the problem. So next door, we had the reading program. And so we'd encourage the kids to go, and because I also taught adult literacy, to go in and learn to read, because actually they could see the point of it. But also, it was things like people who actually worked on the station, the young people there, they gained confidence, they learned how to speak up and to speak out. And you'll remember the lads, any young person in prison, they've always got their heads right down here and their hands somewhere you wouldn't want to mention. And that seems to be the case that it is now. But they increased in confidence, became much more communicative. I had the privilege of taking three young people with the person who helped me set up the Prison Radio Association to the House of Lords. And we went and had tea at the House of Lords. They were amazing. They were engaged. None of them had ever drunk out of a cup and saucer. As for a tea cake, that was a complete misnomer. But we took them into the main chamber. They listened to some of the stuff that was going on. We introduced them to people in the tea room where we were having tea. And it was a real privilege to be with them. I mean, they weren't going to go on and be radio presenters on Radio 1. But, you know, some of them were going to be plumbers and decorators and everything else. But to see how their whole persona had been transformed by working on a radio station was phenomenal. Never, ever can give up on any of them.
Yeah, great to hear that impact in terms of literacy as well, that people needed to be able to read.
Thank you. That's a great story, Roma. Can I take you back a bit? You were talking about the early days of the radio in Feltham, which sounds amazing. It's just like going back a century, the early days of radio. And you mentioned a conductive loop system. Can you just explain what that is? Roughly.
I'll try. It's basically, I mean, it is a wiring system that we had to run along across all the tops of all the units where the lads were. And it came down into the units, and it was managed by, you've got me there because I'm not a technician, by a loop system. So it was entirely within the prison. So in other words, no one else could listen to it. None of the officers or anybody outside could listen to it. It could only be downloaded on this very, very unusual 999 AM. So we had to be unbelievably careful in case anyone listened in, because we knew that if we got anything wrong, we'd be out in our ear. But in about 1996, 1997, we were able to put up a pole outside where you could actually stream it out within a 5 mile radius. So during Prisoners Week, we would have a week when the conductive loop system would join in to this other system and it would spread out to a 5 mile radius. So that was challenging, because of course the people who began to listen were all the young women on the outside. And we also had a phone that people could ring in. I mean, the prison were amazing, very trusting. So we had to manage all those calls from the young girls ringing in, wanting to put music out, wanted to talk to the boys. So we learned an awful lot doing that. And that was, I think, the beginning of an idea about how we could spread the word and we didn't have to just be inside the prison. Because with doing that, it was very tricky, because we couldn't really spread the word and get other prisoners to do it. So in that sense, we were looking for a sort of new technological sort of breakthrough. And that came in about 2004-2005. But in the meantime, the radio station at Felton was being integrated into education. We were getting a lot of interest from people on the outside. And what happened in one of those times when it was reaching out to the wider public was when I met somebody called Lord Andrew Phillips, who was the legal eagle for Radio 2. And he was a Lib Dem peer. And he came out in about 2004, maybe a bit before then, 2003. And while I was working there as a voluntary sector coordinator, and I showed him around, he'd heard about it through a friend, had listened to it somewhere 5 miles away, and said to me, "You have got to bottle this. You have got to get this out, and I'm going to help you." So he did two things. First of all, he helped me set up the charity and paid for it because I didn't have any money. And secondly, he introduced me to people at the BBC. So he said to me, "The first thing I want you to do is I want you to write to Greg Dyke." And I thought, "Well, who's Greg Dyke?" I didn't know. So he said, "Do just write to him and tell him everything that you want." So I did. I wrote to him and told him what we were doing and saying I would like to be able to do some work experience. I'd like some more help with what we're doing. I'd like more people to come out and present on the radio station, blah, blah, blah. And it sort of hit the ground running at the BBC. And somebody called Michael Hastings, who was head of corporate and social responsibility, came out and visited together with the controller of Radio 1. And that was about 2004, 2005. The BBC then agreed to second somebody from the BBC to come and help me expand it. I'd stepped back from Feltham at that point because I was running a consultancy with a friend to support prisons. And between the support from the BBC, I managed to set up the charity, Prison Radio Association, had no money, found myself supporting and looking after this young person who we interviewed who worked with the Jeremy Vine show, who agreed to come on and help. We got allocated a prison, HMP Ewell Grange, to work with them. And so we began to look at how we could expand the whole arena of prison radio. And that person who came on as a volunteer through, he's being paid by the BBC, is now our chief exec, Phil Maguire. Actually, and I remember very clearly, it was, we agreed to go up to Lancaster, HMP Lancaster Farms, to talk to some of the people there about a radio station. And it was snowing and it was February. And I remember going up there, and as we were coming out, he said, "Roma, I want you to say something. I don't want to work for the BBC anymore. I want to come and work for you." And I thought, "Oh, I haven't got any money." I persuaded the BBC to give me a bit more money for a bit longer. And long story short, we got the money and he started 6 months later. And that's, again, how it, you have something, how things happen. And it's about not saying no when you see something that's so worthwhile and just having courage. I came home and thinking, "Oh, my goodness." But I couldn't let down Andrew Phillips, who'd been so supportive. I couldn't let down the BBC, who were really being amazing. But most of all, I couldn't let down all the people who would benefit from greater access to prison radio.
That's tremendous. I mean, the reason I was asking you about the conductive loop, actually, was because I'm interested in happenstance and timing. Because what I'd been thinking was, well, you couldn't get away with that. Now, the security manager would think that's a ligature. Somebody will have that wiring down in a shot and be hanging themselves. So, I mean, what I'm doing is I'm trying to think, what is it? What is it that has made these things happen? And it's clearly something to do with timing and chance, but also something, well, a lot to do with you and your drive and your persistence, and presumably also something about your charm, if I can use that word, because you persuaded people to do things. But then just now you mentioned something very interesting, I think. You were saying, I couldn't let down so-and-so, I couldn't let down this person, I couldn't let down that person, which tells us, I think, something about you and your sense of duty and responsibility.
Yes, and it's very much founded in my childhood, actually, a bit of background. We had a very complicated childhood, and two things came from that. It's taken me a long time to work this out, actually, is that one of the things that I was always told by my grandmother, because my father left home and then died when I was 11, was you've got to look after your mother, make sure she's all right, keep her happy, don't cause any problems, be, you know, support her, be there. And when things were very tough for her, one of the things I was deeply conscious of was how good she was at accepting help. And I just thought, I've never consciously thought about it when I was young, not least when I started working, doing the radio station, but ultimately, surely one of the reasons, if not the only reason, and main reason why we are here, is to help others. And I don't mean that in a trite way. I mean it in a way that what's the point of actually existing if you're not there to support others, whether it's your family or your friends or whether it's those very people that I now fully support. But if you don't, then what would society look like? If there weren't people like the three of us and all the people that you meet, what would the world be like? And we've moved, I think, to quite a sort of selfish environment. And I think for me, it was about thinking, well, I can't give up because you can't give up when I've got a younger brother and a younger sister. I've got to be cheerful. I've got to be the one that's happy. If there's anything horrible going to happen, like going to the dentist, I was always going in first. All those things that you do just to make sure that others were okay. And it's not a badge of honour at all. It's just what you've got. So I suppose it's all about being solution orientated. And when you get the chance, like we did with Prison Radio, which I did with Mark Robinson, doing something so unique that no one had even thought about it before, and that you could have an immediate impact and see the rise in the impact. I don't suppose we've ever seen it so starkly as it has been over the last 2 years. And the government, I have to say, the MOJ, have been very supportive. Because for a lot of the people, the majority who've been locked up, as we all know, the radio station has been their go-to. And we've had people saying we saved their lives. Isn't that what it's about? Isn't that at the end of the day, to say if you can save someone's life or to move someone's life in that direction rather than the one that they were going on before, then that's all you can ever hope to do. You're not going to change everybody. You're not going to save everybody. Of course you can't. But to know that you can even save one. When I saw those kids, I have to say, experienced some really very sad things at Feltham. Because very often they just didn't have anybody. But even a radio is better than nothing. To hear voices, particularly because we work with people who are in prison. So in other words, it's the very people who they understand. We don't think we should be the ones that are going on and talking. Actually, the whole point is to have those very people who they know and recognise, the people who've actually been inside and understand what it's like to be in prison. They're the ones the best to actually do everything on the radio station. They're the ones that should be talking about what it's like to be homeless. They're the ones who should be talking about what's changed their life and how hard it was, but they did. It's giving people hope. And prison doesn't always give hope. It kind of strips it away. So we all have a responsibility to give people hope, because I think prison can just, these IPP prisoners, I just think it's terrible. And the fact that we've got an increasing number of governments, not just this one, who want to lock up people for longer. What does that do to people's mental health? What does that do to their whole reason for existing?
So just thinking about the prison radio, you've told us about how that started and it now extends to the whole of the prison system, is that right?
Thanks to satellite. Now I can talk about satellite because that was the saving grace that gets me to out of talking about conductive loop systems. In about 2005, 2006, we realised that actually we could broadcast the radio station through satellite. So then I discovered it because I'd heard about a chap called Bruno Brooks who used to work for the BBC. And I'd heard that he set up a series of little mini radio stations in Newbury. So I went down and had a look and I thought, these people are broadcasting to Denmark. They're broadcasting to Lloyd's Pharmacy. Then why can't we do something similar? And we were very fortunate that the governor who I'd worked with very closely at Feltham took on the role of governor at Brixham Prison. And he was always very enthusiastic about the radio station. And so when he moved there and we set up, we realised we could do it, we could do it through satellite. That was the beginning of us being able to really expand it. So we had Electric Radio, Brixton, which was broadcast inside, but then we realised that we could do it through a very different system. So, to explain how it works, initially, of course, a lot of our ideas came from hospital radio and stuff like that. But what happened was we realised that what we could do was stream the radio station through the television sets. Because, of course, when we started, people weren't getting TVs. But now, pretty well, every prisoner has access to television. And that we could become the fifth channel. So if you stay in a hotel or somewhere and they put up something that tells you what's going on in the hotel or anywhere, we could actually broadcast through that. That's exactly how we do it now. Go through the television set so everyone can listen to it. The other thing to remember is we have to compete with all the other radio stations. So people can listen to Kiss FM. They can listen to other stuff. So we have to work even harder to make it relevant to the very people who are listening. And we have to make it relevant to 15-year-olds, to 19-year-olds, to children, women, people with all sorts of other issues. So we have to work really hard to sort of find the right sort of trigger that will get people to listen. And that has not come on a plate. It's taken us, a lot of these things take short time. It takes quite a long time.
So what is the difference then? Why would someone listen to prison radio rather than Radio 1, Radio 4, whatever?
Because we're giving them something that they really want. So we've done some amazing programmes. I can't show you because you can't see, but I've got awards in the background from the radio station. Around suicide and self-harm is critical. We've done a lot of work on and off over the years around that. To talk about homelessness, to talk about how job creation, how to get jobs, talk about family. Family is really important. How to encourage people to reconnect with their family. We have one of our shows is enabling people to call in and to request music to be played for people in prison. That's incredibly popular. We got the Red Bull music stream that comes in as well. We have presenters coming in. We have people who are involved either with prisons or completely different. The guy who wrote Time on television, he came out. And try and make sure we invite people to come in that people actually want to listen. So what we've done is we've got a really good relationship with Inside Time, which is a magazine that goes to every prisoner in the country. And on the back of that, you will see our programme. So every prisoner will have a chance to see it. Also, we get the voluntary sector doing a lot of programmes to promote the work they're doing. And remember, we still have a very high level of illiteracy in prisons. So if they can't read it, at least they can hear about it. So the whole point is it's got to be relevant for them, and it can be a bit of fun. You know, we've tried all sorts of things. So, and we're constantly surveying prisoners' views. Okay, so what do you want? What would you prefer to have? Is this something that you'd like? So that we're making sure that we are appealing directly to them. And that's really how it's grown. It's got an educational bias. We're on the intranet, we're on the new digital hub. So that those prisoners who have access to iPad, you know, and that sort of thing, are able to download and be able to listen to what we're doing. We have a reading group, we have a book club, and so they get to discuss certain books and stuff like that. So we've got a good relationship with a number of other voluntary sector agencies. But we can, most critically, promote the very, very work that's going on in prison that would benefit them, because so often they don't hear about it.
So it sounds as if the station is able to engender a kind of sense of community as well.
Yeah, and also we encourage those that have done really well working with us, we will often employ them to come back and do more programming. And we also have on our board two people who've been in prison, who themselves are part of the radio station, one at Stile Prison and one at Brixton. So I am really, really keen to make sure that we're speaking to appropriately to the very people we're there to support. And we couldn't do it without the support of having trustees who've got lived experience. That's really how the radio station sort of developed, because when it very first started, and I was running Friends of Feltham, I insisted on having two of the lads from the radio station on our committee. Because, I mean, I didn't think it was anything odd, but I realised that actually people just didn't do that kind of thing. And I just said, we don't know what they want, even if we talk to them. We want to have them, invite them into an environment where they feel happy to share what they feel. And they were brilliant. And we did that all the way through. And I think that as adults, we could be appallingly bad at particularly asking young people, actually, what do they want? You know, what works for them? We think we know it, but we absolutely do not know it.
Yeah, I was really interested also in your new narratives document that was published and some of the other work that you've done outside of the radio programme.
Yes. the radio station is always my heart and soul. But one of the things I'm passionate about as well is the voluntary sector and the role that we can play in supporting actually not just prisoners, but the prisons themselves, actually. So when I, having done my sort of 2-year stint with Feltham Young Offenders as a paid worker, I then ran a consultancy primarily to work with prisons about how they can raise awareness about what the voluntary sector were doing, help them identify the organisations that they were perhaps missing, doing kind of an audit, that kind of stuff, and also steering people towards raising money and giving them a bit of a hand about sort of PR and stuff. So I did that for a while, but I suppose in the meantime, there was this opportunity to get involved with various different aspects of the sector. So getting involved with the women's sector as the chair of the Griffin Society, initially as a trustee, opened my mind to what was going on behalf of women who had committed offences. And that sort of gave me another layer, if you like, from working with young people in prison to understanding how it's affecting young women and girls in prison and women in, because actually was a real eye-opener. And I did that for quite a while with the Griffin Society, but more than anything, having worked at Feltham and seeing what was happening with young women and women going into prison, I realised that there was this appalling gap in understanding about locking people up for short sentences. And I was getting really frustrated with government at the time, it was actually the Labour Party, about what they were doing, and this kind of two-sided view about, yes, we want to help people, but two, we're going to lock you up. So I got encouraged by somebody who I'd met through doing Common Purpose, actually, this course, who said to me one day, you really, really need to set up a campaign. So that was what I did in 2008, 2009. And out of that came a bunch of literature to support the hypotheses and the very clear data about why it is really, really not a good idea to be locking up people for short sentences. So we did some really sort of meta-analysis in community sentences to look at what was available and to get a much better understanding about community sentencing and their value. We did a piece on some other areas like victims and also other bits and pieces that were going on in the sort of system at the time. And I remember going to quite a number of party conferences, and I can remember collaring Jack Straw in the corridor. And I say, oh, you, what is this about building prison ships? And yet you have this amazing idea about alternatives to prison. That was a real flagship. But I said, look, we've just been around the country looking at some of these amazing community sentences and yet you still want to lock people up for longer. And I just felt that was such a shame in a way, because he so easily could have just turned it around. Because actually that research, I took Peter Oborne with me just to prove this was a non-political campaign, because it wasn't political. And Peter Oborne chaired it, and we went all around the country looking at various different community sentences, one dealing with mental health, one dealing with young people, one dealing with alcohol, drugs and alcohol, and also I think it was to do with women, and and there's really, really interesting alternative to custody in Manchester. And we had some really interesting findings about how valuable they were. The campaign, the thing was, going back to something that you said earlier on, one of the things I don't have is fear of authority. You know, I don't put anybody on a pedestal, actually. I'm not that they don't deserve to be, and some of them are close to it, but actually, generally speaking, not a good idea, that I don't speak to anybody. So I wasn't afraid to go and talk to ministers about what I thought. And what surprised me more than anything was that in general, they usually agreed with me. In public, they didn't. Even Jacob Rees-Mogg agreed with me. So just goes to show the amount of political swing maybe the Daily Mail has, which was our general feeling. But it was a very, very, one of the, if not the hardest thing I've ever done, trying to persuade government. And do you know what? Part of me thinks that actually should have just been an MP, because sometimes you have to do more, you get more done inside, but then you get tainted. Very, very difficult to know. I think it was something you were saying earlier on, Naomi, about position. Where does the power lie? And I realised that the power is very slippery and very convenient for some people. And actually, it's incredibly hard. When you've done it for 30 years, and my heart goes out to Frances Crook, actually, who's just stepped down from the Howard League. She worked tirelessly. And what happens is, it goes like this. Imagine a graph. So I've been on a graph where it's gone up and things have really improved, at Felton particularly. Then it goes down again, and then it goes up again. And you're thinking, I'm getting somewhere. People are beginning to listen. And then it goes down again. And so it goes on. For me, it was almost like watching somebody with a heart monitor on in 2013, when you realise the line starts to go like that. And it was when Chris Grayling came in and privatised probation and did an awful lot to damage the role of the voluntary sector and the prison service, actually. And I stopped the campaign then because I couldn't ask for funding to carry on doing something which I honestly didn't think would have any impact. And I was right. It was better to do something practical and go back to, you know, where I started, really. And I have met the most amazing prison officers. I couldn't have done my job without the prison officers that I have met. And I still believe that they are fundamental to the well-being of our prisoners in this country, and that we don't give them anything like the support and attention they deserve. Not because I don't think governors want to do it, because the funding, et cetera, et cetera, and the way that they're recruited, because they are part and parcel. I remember when I was doing adult literacy with this young man who couldn't read or write. He loved anything to do with motorbikes. And he was such a lovely guy. And he used to help with, we have peacocks at Feltham, which were horrendous, the noise. Ah, and actually one governor, he said, you've got to get rid of them. I can't stand them any longer. But this young man used to look after the peacocks. And one day he didn't come to his class and I couldn't understand what had happened. He was profoundly dyslexic and he had obviously upset his personal officer. So I went along and had a chat. I said, well, I don't understand what's happened because this guy's doing really well. He said, oh, he was really rude, blah, 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 blah. I said, you do know that he's extremely dyslexic. He looked at me and he said, I'm dyslexic too. I said, well, why don't you have a conversation with him? Because I think they both had similar issues, but neither understood the other. Because I know, having a dyslexic daughter, that you can very easily misunderstand somebody. And after that, it was fine. He's back on track again, came to his lessons, and everything settled down. We don't have that anymore. We don't have the person officer scheme in the same way, which is such a shame. Because I think, it's been a while since I've actually physically worked in a prison, and I know it's changed. I mean, I've been back to Feltham. I know it's changed, and the people that are going there are different. And the crimes that have been committed are complex and a lot around gangs, and it needs a completely different way of thinking. But, you know, there's such a shame, because I do think there's an awful lot to be said for good relationships. It's all about relationships, isn't it, at the end of the day? All about relationships.
Yeah, I think we're with you there too, certainly. So you said something a bit earlier on, which really struck me. You said that you have, you have no fear of authority. And I was really struck by that, really impressed by that. But also, it occurs to me that so many of the people we've worked with, be they young people or older people, actually are scared of authority. And it's that fear of authority that they only know how to combat with violence so often. And yet our society is riven with this idea that you have to be scared, you have to kowtow to authority.
What I would add to that is, yes, I have no fear of authority, but I do respect authority. I think there's a profound difference. sorry, I've just seen Kat go across the screen. is that actually, if you want to turn anyone's lives around and you're in a position of authority, you should expect, you should encourage respect, because I think that's often what goes wrong. Of course you have to have people who are leaders, but they need to engender authority. They need to engender respect. People need to feel that they can respect them. The people at Feltham and other prisons that I worked at, governors particularly, who do the best jobs, are where the people respect them and realise that they're fair. And that even when they've done something wrong, that young person, that woman or whatever, if they know that it's being done fairly and justly, they get it. I've got children of my own. They recognise when they've done something wrong and you've had to explain to them. And they, as long as they feel they've been treated fairly, then it doesn't matter what position you're in. You build a bridge between the person up here and the person down here. It belongs in the middle. And you get that by respect, not talking down to people, not making people fearful, but talking with them with respect and recognising we all have values, that we have value to each other, and people are worth listening to. Listening to people, particularly those young people and adults and young women in prison, got to listen, not tell them.
Yeah, well, as you say, fairness is very important in all of this. And of course is currently what runs through the whole narrative of our social discourse, a sense of unfairness. So I'm just thinking, because time is getting on, Roma, you've told us a lot about yourself. And earlier on you mentioned being able to bottle something from Feltham Radio and then extend that to the whole of the prison service. I'm kind of wondering what it is about yourself that we can in some way bottle and extend to other people. What is it about you and your particular skills do you think that other people can learn from?
Oh, and there's lots of people like me out there, because I'm not the only one. There are lots of people who are passionate, enthusiastic, energetic, who don't give up. I used to be, I don't like the term, called a bit of a Pollyanna. I am optimistic. I am also realistic. So some of the work I do now as a sort of mentor is get them to bottle what you just said, bottle the enthusiasm and energy that they've got with a good dose of realism, but not to be fearful of taking what they want to do and moving it forward. Because my role now is to keep on supporting other people who would benefit from just understanding how important it is to network, how important it is to talk to people, how important it is to listen to what people think about what you're doing. Never make people wrong. It's a terrible mistake. And I suppose if you're enthusiastic and passionate, it's just catching. I mean, I get it from other people who are enthusiastic and passionate about what they're doing, and it could be about something completely different. You know, it could be about animals, for instance. I see the cat going around the back of you, Naomi. You know, everyone's got it in them, but it's also about not thinking you have to do it on your own. And I know that I could only have done what I've done with all these different ingredients of other people coming on board. You know, you just don't do it in a vacuum. And I am optimistic. I do believe in people. And I am a bit of a solution. I'm slightly solution oriented, which could be a bit annoying. I do like to sort of see if we can work things out. I don't give up, actually. I don't think I can give up. But you're absolutely right. No, the whole point about anyone, like any of us that have a passion, is you've got to share it with other people because it's catching. It is definitely catching, and that's what makes it worthwhile. And it's exhausting. I exhaust myself sometimes. It's very tiring. But it, you know, I'm talking to some young people at the moment who are establishing a school in Uganda. And all I'm doing is just keeping them enthusiastic themselves, keeping them passionate about what they believe in, by believing in them. It's got to be true. Got to believe in them.
Thank you.
So I think we're probably about our last question, Roma, which is, you know, the work that you're doing brings you in contact with some of the elements of society that are really quite sad and quite painful, aren't they? Thinking about all those young people, for instance, in Feltham, and just wondering how you manage to keep yourself in that kind of that positive, fresh, emotionally strong way, the Pollyanna-like, as you've said. How do you keep yourself so upbeat?
I think I'm very lucky to have a very strong family who keep me on the ground. Don't let me get carried away. Help me keep a sense of perspective. I got very good friends who have been on that journey with me. And I keep in touch with lots of people I've worked with, whether they're governors or officers or people who've been inside the teams I've worked with. You have to look after, more than anything, you realise this during COVID, you have to look after yourself, and sometimes it's hard. And so I have to get out, I have to walk, I have to breathe, I have to have space. So if ever I start to feel enclosed, which can happen, my immediate instinct is to want to get out and be in space. And once I do that, I can breathe. But I think more than anything, it's because you know that what you're doing is, even if it only has a little bit of impact, it's helping. But, you know, I've got a cat and a dog. So, you know, it's about having warmth and just other people around you, really, who perhaps are enthusiastic and share with what you do. And I think someone once said to me, who I knew very well for a long time, she said to me, just go ahead and do what you think is best and then apologize afterwards. So holding on to that, because people will derail you. People will say, you can't do that. You can't do that. And actually, that's not true. You can. It's going back to what you were saying, David, you know, how do you spread it? Well, you just encourage people to keep on doing it. I have had some wake-up calls. Like my youngest, when I used to, I used to bring her into Feltham when she was about 8. And I can remember bringing a birthday cake in for one of the guys I was teaching. Actually, it was the one who had the dyslexic problem. I took him in a birthday cake. And she said to me a few years later, you know, Mum, she said, I reckon you love those young offenders more than you love me. That's not true. But, you know, that's my what I'm here to, you know, what I'm for. And actually, they're all been huge supporters and great advocates of what I do. And other than one other thing, no one's allowed to say to me either, is when you're going to retire. That is not a word in my narrative at all. So I suppose my absolute plea to all of you that are out there thinking of starting up something, give it a go. You've got nothing to lose. The only people who will lose out are the very people that you want to help. Talk to other people, share it. Don't feel you're on your own. Take a chance. Everything's a gamble. But if you don't succeed, just try again, basically. And yes, have a life outside, because actually otherwise it can be very overwhelming.
Fantastic words of wisdom, Roma. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Roma. Real pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to rabbit on about myself, but thank you very much.
No, that was terrific. Thank you. And I'm sorry about the cat. I've tried twice to already put it out prior to this conversation. So,
oh, it's lovely. I've seen dogs, cats, everything, children. This whole world has changed.
Yes, absolutely. That was a lovely conversation with Roma, just such an upbeat person. And I can't help but think she was being a bit too humble when she dismissed a lot of this as being kind of around luck, because I've got a friend who says you don't inherit luck, you make your own luck. And I think that's probably very true. And I think, you know, you could just hear Roma's energy and perseverance at things that must have taken an awful lot of those qualities to pull off something like getting Prison Radio up and running.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think Roma's full of enthusiasm, and it's her enthusiasm and determination which gets things done. And she's a real kind of credit, really, as someone who... She's a real kind of example to all of us, I think.